Moncrief on News Talk.
Different periods in history are, of course, connected. The roots for the Celtic Tiger lie before the Celtic Tiger in the 1990s. The roots of the economic crash lie in the Celtic Tiger. The historian Dermot Ferriter's book is entitled The Revelation of Ireland, 1995 to 2000. Dermot, good afternoon.
Nice to see you, Sean.
Is it difficult? Because I suppose if it's 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you can look back and you can go, well, that was a significant event now in hindsight. I assume it's more difficult in a period of history that most of us remember.
It's tricky because it's the first time I've written about a period in great depth that I've lived through. Now, that makes it more interesting in lots of ways, but you don't have the same kind of sources that you'd be used to using. The way I would have worked in the past is I'd bury myself in the archive, particularly our state paper rule, you know, where state papers can be released after 30 years has passed and you'd bury yourself in them and then you'd resurface and try and piece together a narrative and an analysis. So this is a very different kind of challenge. But it struck me how short our memories are as well. There are things that we live through that we recognise at the time are of significance, but we tend to move on very quickly. And I was very conscious as well of just the avalanche of information that came in to the public domain and into the domain of historians as well in the last 25 years or so. I was reading a book by Richard Fisher, who's a former BBC journalist, and he was talking about the long view and how we've lost it. He said the tyranny of the instant is the age that we're living through and the treadmill of the unending now. And I thought it was an interesting point because he was saying we're constantly in a rush to decide now and to make pronouncements about very complex matters, often through social media as well, because technology, of course, is one of the other big changes. But that you do need a bit more nuance if you want to get some kind of a historical perspective on it. So I was interested, I suppose, in looking at the things that preoccupied us, but not looking at them through the short-term lens, looking through them, the long-term lens. You mentioned roots there, which I think is hugely important. An awful lot of what we've been preoccupied with in recent decades, whether that's the collapse of the authority of the Catholic Church, you were talking there about divorce and, you know, social change, when you consider the housing issue that we constantly talk about. If you want to understand any of those issues, you know, and our politics and our economics, you do have to look at the roots, you know. So it was trying to make sense of what has preoccupied us in recent years by taking that longer view.
Yeah, because you could... That period of time you're covering, a tremendous period of change, a lot of stuff happened. What things didn't change? What things stayed the same?
Well, this is the thing about the continuities. You know, what are we talking about today in terms of current affairs? An awful lot of the issues that we were talking about 20 years ago. How do you manage wealth, for example? We're not very good at managing wealth. You know, this is a modern challenge. I remember going through Department of Finance files in the late 1990s. And what they were suggesting is that we need to aim for medium-term sustainable growth, which doesn't sound very sexy, but it's also very sensible because it means you're not lurching from excess to penury, you know, as we often have done. And what they were suggesting is that if you want medium-term sustainable growth, you shouldn't be increasing your current expenditure by more than 4% per year. So these would be fairly dry memoranda in the Department of Finance. And of course, they made sense in terms of sustainable public finance. Now, do you think the politicians decided to follow that advice? No, they didn't. There were some years where it was actually four times 4%, 16% the increase in current expenditure. And again, we talk about the bubble and the boom and the collapse of the boom, and you can see the roots of it there. We're not far off that now in terms of advice being ignored. I've referred sometimes to the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council as peeing in the wind when they come out with their report.
Which they did this morning as well,
actually.
Which,
again, they've done this morning. We're still talking about it today. And again, it's the same thing. You know, you've got to think long term. You've got to look at what's manageable and what's sustainable instead of giving into the temptation to satisfy a particular group of people or a particular sector. So there are continuities in relation to that. There was profound change. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I'm very conscious wearing my historian's hat that we're a country that had experienced such exodus and emigration. It was really remarkable to read the census returns of 2011, where you discover that 17% of the population of the Republic at that stage had been born outside of Ireland. 36% of the people living in Gort in Galway in 2011 were from Brazil. You know, and it's a remarkable turnaround. That's the great historical role reversal, really. So you get that profound change, and yet you get continuities in terms of how particular social challenges are managed. Very interested in relation to housing, how we lost the balance between social housing and private housing, because there used to be much more of a balance.
On that, and because I suppose the perennials are managing money, the health service and housing. Is that ideologically driven? Is it politically driven? Is it kind of the old Charlie McCreevy, if I have it, I'll spend it kind of, but it's just maybe dressed up in different language now?
The language changes, but an awful lot of the practices don't. You know, privatisation is a very obvious theme. You talked about Charlie McCreevy there. He would dispute the idea that he should be remembered for when I have it, I spend it, because what he also said is that if I don't have it, I don't spend it. And, you know, he felt unfairly pilloried in relation to that. But you know what he said at that time? He said, I can't, for political reasons, run a surplus in the budget. Now, think about that for a moment.
Wow.
I can't put money away for a rainy day because I have all these people screaming at me, you've got money to spare, and we need to solve all of these problems. So it's partly about that, but it's also about us not learning enough from the kind of Scandinavian model. Sweden have a thing called the level of living concept. It's not just about the money in your pocket. It's about the quality of your life. You know, now that brings in obviously income and housing and education and childcare and all of these things that we didn't do enough to attend to, and a lot of people feeling aggrieved, even in the midst of very considerable economic success and richness. And again, you know, we're facing that at the moment as well. But what also engulfed me, I suppose, from the 1990s on was this question of the revelations. What was coming out about how we had managed things in the past and how we had managed people and how we had hidden people? And again, I don't need to labour the point about all the revelations. Mm-hmm. Talk about the revelations of Ireland. It was this idea of trying to come to terms with both a public and a private past for many people about what had been done and what had been taboo and what had been hidden. And I was very influenced by a lot of the novelists who were writing about those themes, because they were providing something of an emotional soundtrack to those years, because they were getting into the interior of what people might have been thinking or feeling. You know, I can, as a historian, go into an archives and find an awful lot of information on what happened and what perspectives existed in terms of policy making or political attitudes, or indeed economic attitudes. You don't necessarily get much on what it felt like. Novelists sometimes can go to those places that we as historians cannot necessarily reach.
Yeah.
And I remember reading Anne Enright's The Gathering. Do you remember that novel? Yeah. It was published in 2007. It won the Booker Prize, actually. But it was about a family trying to come to terms with the loss of their brother. And they're trying to make sense of it. And the sister of the dead brother, she writes about trying to search for something that she doesn't quite know what is. And she said she felt it roaring inside her. And she's not quite sure what it is. She thought it might be a crime of the flesh, as she put it. But the flesh has long since gone away, and she doesn't know what hurt still lingered in the bones. And it really struck me that an awful lot of people were dealing with that idea of coming to terms with devastation. And we've had a whole plethora of reports and commissions of investigation. And I mean, they're remarkably dense sources for people to try and you know, utilise personal testimony to understand what it felt like. But again, we need to put it into context. I remember the Archbishop of Dublin, the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin, in 2018, he just asked a simple question. He said, what was it in the Irish Catholic Church that made it so harsh? And my answer to that, which was a very long answer, is that you have to go right back to the 19th century to understand how the church developed in Ireland and the structure of the church and the power of the church and the tone of the church. So again, it's an example of something being brought up in a very modern way, because no Catholic Archbishop of Dublin would have said that 50 or 60 years ago. But then you got to go digging very, very deep to try and understand how it evolved.
So the place we're in now and the place we were in 5 years ago, where your book ends, are we in a process now of trying to figure out who we are, or even is there a struggle about defining who we are?
I mean, that's always ongoing. And I mean, I was very interested in tracing political change, because the very obvious change during this period is the collapse of civil war politics.
Yeah.
You know, the two big beasts weren't as dominant anymore. They may be in government now, but their share of the vote has shrunk dramatically. But it wasn't necessarily replaced by something very solid and identifiable. Mm. So it's very fractured. You know, so, you know, when you talk of where we are now, we're in that kind of fractured zone where the old certainties are not there in terms of politics, where the old certainties in terms of beliefs and indeed religious practice are not there. Some people would regret that because they think it gave us an anchoring or a mooring of some kind. So there's a lot more vacuum, I suppose, you could argue.
Yeah.
And some would trace that back perhaps to the period of the Celtic Tiger as well. And yet we also have a richness. I didn't want this book to be a chronicle of disappointment or gloom. There's an awful richness there in terms of the culture, and music and literature and plays can be a real reflector of anxiety, but also a deflector of anxiety and the troubles. And people have come up with marvellous ways to find their expression of Irishness. You know?
Yeah, indeed. The book is called The Revelation of Ireland, 1995 to 2020. Jim and Ferrier, thanks a million.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.